We live in an age of incredible change. This is not news to anybody. But every once in a while, I bump into a recording of it or a documenting of it that feels like it gets a hold of me again. And I read this past week that the BBC had to abandon a media delivery infrastructure reconfiguration project on which they had already spent £100 million, not dollars, pounds, because technology is changing so fast that it had basically outstripped and made irrelevant their infrastructure change. Ow! So jobs were lost, etc., you know. But when you hit a story like that every once in a while, you kind of go, that's nuts. And we get reminded again that the rate of change, and that's just an indices of rate of change, but that the rate of change in our culture is sometimes just insane. I think it would be fair to wonder what that has to do with parent-child dedication. So I'm going to try to connect those dots. I think they're connected. And two things that come to mind right away. One is that the rate and the magnitude of change that we live with has a real impact on our understanding of the thing we would call family, this thing that has to do with having children at all, and with our understanding of what it means to be family. And I'm not going to get into this a lot, this part of it a lot this morning, because it's a huge topic, but I do want to note this, because I think it has more impact than we usually stop to be conscious of. The fact that we live in an age and in a culture where we have almost 100% control of the positive aspect of conception, and that we have the technology for the first time perhaps in human history to choose to have biological children outside of physical intimacy for conception, means that we live in an age where the idea of family, how we come to it, what it is, what constitutes it, why we would bother and how we would get there, that all of those things are in real concrete ways up for reconsideration. And for the first time in history as well, I think it would be fair to say that when it comes to trying to figure out what it means to be family, love has never mattered more. Augustine once famously reminded Jerome, early church father, that it's not from marriage that babies come, but from sex. I don't know a lot about Jerome, but apparently he needed that piece of information. Now we would, if we were Augustine and we were speaking to the poignancy of that, we would have to say it's really not necessarily from either. They're not, either of them, necessary for the thing that we call family, to the degree that this means having babies. But can we have that thing that we name with the word family? Can we have that thing without love? Love has never mattered more. It's never mattered more. The other thing that kind of flows out of some of these realities about our culture is that we live in an age where children are not categorically regarded as a treasure or as wealth. And this is very significant. In cultures where survival is still the primary agenda, historically in cultures where that has been the case, and in cultures present day where that is the case, children are still most often thought of as a treasure, as a certain kind of wealth. Why isn't it that way in our culture? Well, the short version of that is that we live in a relatively wealthy and luxurious culture in which the implicit understanding is often that the first call on the human person is self-actualization. That the most important thing we can do as a human being is fulfill our personal self-destiny. And so children, rather than being regarded as a treasure or as wealth, come to be regarded far too often as an interruption to the process of self-actualization. Anybody who's ever had children knows that this is true. Children are an enormous interruption in the process of self-actualization. Anyway. That's to sell the whole question of what actually fulfills the self rather short. But the way our culture often defines those things, this is not an unfair conclusion to reach. It does beg the question about this subtext, though. The subtext in that understanding is the question, is self-actualization the first call on the human person? Is this actually the most important thing that we could do with our lives? Because if realizing our personal potential is actually our first vocation, that will have an enormous impact on why we think having children and raising children is significant at all. So maybe that's an idea that needs some challenging. It might mean that in order to continue to regard having and raising children as significant, we need to look somewhere other than our prevailing culture for ideas and even affirmation about that. We might not just sort of stumble into that the way you would in a different culture and time. We might not inherit that from our family of origin or our culture of origin. And that brings me to the second thing that comes to mind, which is that here at the table, we often find ourselves looking for features of faith or features of belief that have something about them that I would call essential. And I've used the phrase, the thing behind the thing behind the thing, recently to try to get at that. Intriguingly, that also often means that we end up looking at ways of thinking about life or about living life, about the practice of belief, that might survive or even transcend changes in culture. Ways of thinking about what it means to believe something, and then thinking about what it means to live the thing you believe in such a way that the culture that frames it could shift, and you would still have the essence of that thing. So it can work in culture, but it's not pinned to it or its existence, if that helps. And often, when we start to think like that, we find ourselves having to challenge the prevailing norms, because a disproportionate number of the prevailing norms are driven by market. They're driven by the reality of, if I can get somebody to think or feel this way, I can sell them something. You know? Don't get me going. Okay. I saw a couple people nod. I'll talk to you. No, I gotta say something about this. Have you ever noticed how much advertising lately has nothing to do with the product? Okay, good enough. That's what's going on, right? We're going to create the sensation inside that I need this, or what? Or I won't be self-actualized, and we already talked about how that's the most important thing that a human can do. All right. Where were we going? I should know better. We're looking for essential things. That's where we were going. So the question that comes out of that for me is there something that is ancient, if you want, something that's essential, something, I could even use the word like human, something that is at its core human about the thing that we still call family that can or should inform what we're doing here this morning, which is the dedication of a child and family. Now, you're smart people, so you already know this is a rhetorical question. I intend to address myself to this question. When I started poking around at it, I ended up looking for human rituals. And I know as soon as I use the phrase like that, if you're from the table, it's fine. You know, you've kind of heard this language before. And if you're not, you know, pictures of full moon and sacrifice, you know, or whatever. Anyway, human rituals are just things that we do that have a shape to them that's sort of prescribed. They don't necessarily tilt into that other strange terrain. I ended up looking for human rituals that seem to have survived change. So I ended up trying to find rituals that were about this thing that we call family, and ways of elevating both its regard and our understanding of it, the essential nature of it, in the life of a culture. I wanted to see if there were things that were part of ancient cultures that we still practice, even though it looks as though the cultural reasons for their origin no longer exist. So things that came into being in a culture for all sorts of pragmatic reasons, perhaps, as well as sort of, if you will, higher reasons, that even though those pragmatic reasons have drifted off in history, they're no longer common practice, they're no longer needful for whatever reason in the culture, the practice itself has somehow survived. Because to me, that points at that essential nature. That points at that thing that says there's something profoundly and importantly humanizing about this ritual. There's something that takes the essence of the thing that we all are probing when we probe what it means to be a whole self in the presence of other selves and to make a society of that, that somehow stayed intact in the transmission of this ritual through time. And the ritual that I want to work with this morning is one that I'm going to call blessing. Blessing is one of those rituals that seems to have done this. It seems to have tracked through a whole bunch of different cultures. It's present in very ancient cultures. It remains present in our time, although it's not got the same traction. We're going to give it some more traction this morning in this little corner of the universe. But it's present in all sorts of different religious frameworks. It's present in all sorts of different cultural frameworks. It's present in all sorts of different time frameworks. That says something significant to me about what is going on inside a thing like blessing. And in the sense that I'm going to use the word this morning, blessing is one of the most powerful ways that human beings can express love. And remember, among the other features of our culture that we've touched on this morning, it's never been a better time than this to love. And maybe because when we do blessing the way that we can as humans, maybe the fact that it expresses love so powerfully is part of the why that it has survived the way that it has. Maybe that's part of why so many different cultures with so many different ways of belief have practiced some version of this. Because the thing behind the thing behind the thing is that, is love. Maybe every culture has had some elder stand up and say, it's never been a better time for love. We've never needed this more than we need it now. Why? Because I hear the drums pounding in the next valley over, and I don't know if we're going to make it to morning. That's why. I don't know. How can you know these things? It doesn't seem implausible, though. That said, though, blessing is maybe something we don't do much in our daily lives, in our culture, so a two-minute primer on what blessing is, as I'm working with it this morning. And this is an important departure, I think. So just, if you don't get anything else about what a blessing is, get this. Affirming people is important, we know that. But to bless someone is to do something much more substantial than to affirm them. Affirmation is important. The self-esteem movement, if it didn't teach us anything else, it taught us this. But to bless someone is to use the same sorts of tools, most powerfully speaking, that we would use for affirmation. But rather than simply affirming, what we do when we bless someone is we speak positive goodwill toward them, and I'll unpack what goodwill is a little bit later. We bestow favor upon them. And this is interesting, because to bestow something on someone, you have to have it. Right? I can't gift you something I don't have. So to bestow a favor or a blessing on someone means, among other things, that I need to believe that I have one to give. And that's kind of an interesting part of this conversation, isn't it? Because we don't all believe that. To speak positive goodwill toward them, to bestow favor upon them, and to offer them some essential benefit by what we speak. You could, I think, make the case that to bless someone is to behave a little bit like God in their life. And that might seem like biting off more than we can chew, so let me tell you what I mean by that. When we bless someone, we are choosing to come into their world. We are choosing to intervene in their world. We're choosing to get involved in it. And we're choosing to make it plain by how we do that, that we intend to stay involved in it. I realize that our ability to keep those kind of promises is limited. I realize when I say something like that, that we don't always have the last word and whether we will get to do what we said we would do. We've prayed this morning about those parts of the story. I will be at the wedding. All right. But this is, even with those limitations taken into account, this is the way that God behaves with us, but without those limitations. And what I mean by that is that I think we can see in every cohesive and enduring story of God, that God as a being initiates with us, that God launches the story, keeps breaking into the story for the purpose of loving us and for the purpose of figuring out a way to work out this commitment to always be there. And so when I say we bless someone, we behave like God, that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about imitating those kinds of things, imitating initiation, imitating presence, imitating enduring commitment. When we bless someone, we're doing more than just saying nice things or offering our hopes for them. Again, those things are not bad things to do. They pretty much keep the greeting card business going. But that's not the same thing as offering our self to someone. It just isn't. When we bless someone and take that business seriously, which we will get to do this morning, part of what we are doing is offering those we bless our self. Because when we take seriously the business of blessing someone, we're speaking and acting in ways that communicate our presence to that person, our self to that person. And that means that when we talk about extending them our goodwill, what we're talking about is bending our choice toward them, our good choice. Because we can share our ill will as well. We can bend our broken will toward someone and annihilate them. And we can bend our goodwill towards someone and bring gifts that we can't even imagine. So that's where an old piece of English like goodwill can become redolent again, full with the understanding of potential good. And when we take seriously the business of blessing someone, that's part of what we're doing. We're saying, I will extend my willingness to act toward your benefit, however I can. This is what I choose. This is how I will behave, even if it costs something from myself. And we also, if we take seriously the business of blessing someone, we also are making a commitment to, as much as it is up to us, being at peace with them. And that is an enormous thing to commit to in someone's life. These are the kind of things that don't function in another person's life at the same level as good wishes. These are the kind of things that function at the place in someone's life where we are actually saying, I am taking the thing, whatever it is, however kind of language you want to use for it or understand it, I am taking the thing that I would use the word soul for. I am taking the thing that is somehow both the essence of me, and I am bringing it into the presence of you and saying, this is the favor I have to bestow. Man, sorry. The brokenness that makes this so hard to do for so many of us so often is that we don't believe that the self that we have to bestow is actually a gift. And we can't believe that for a huge variety of reasons sometimes, right? big complicated stories that go with that. But not the least of them is that for many of us, we don't believe we have that favor to bestow because nobody bestowed it on us. See the ripple? Do you see how this goes? See how we get to behave something different when we actually choose to bestow the blessing of ourself on another self? Why is that a favor? Well, not the least of the reasons that that is a favor is because just for us to exist as being made by a good God means we arrive with that favor. We don't have to earn that. We don't have to drum it up. We don't have to keep a bunch of rules to have it. We arrive with it, and we arrive with it in a world that is full of it. And when we choose to bless somebody else, we are acknowledging that. So the idea that we would look at ourselves as favored children of a good God and that that would somehow produce an ego issue is utter nonsense. Just completely ridiculous. And when I watch that function in the religious realm, I get seriously pissed. Okay. You don't need my anger. Someday I do. That's so broken. What happens when we live as favored children is we live with a sort of right confidence that allows us to take the kind of risks that humans need to take to love other humans well. And when we bless someone, that's what we're doing. We're actually coming out of this place of, I am a favored child. You are a favored child. And the way that you're going to get the ripple this on into your life, among other things, is if I bestow upon you this blessing. It's crazy. But that seems to be the way it has worked for a long, long time. Maybe all of this is true because in the end, when we bless someone, what we're really offering them is love. Excuse me. And if the story of faith, as Christendom tells it, has any merit at all, then a real core part of that story is that we are made by love. We are the overflow of relational love. The excess of God. The I can't help myself of God. We are made both by that and we are made for that. And to offer a blessing to someone is to address ourselves to both a dignifying, humanizing action, which is the loving of another, and also to speak to an essential and elemental human need, which is the need to be loved. And we get to do that when we bless someone. So how awesome is that? And in the end, you know, to bless someone is an act of faith. Because really, when it comes right down to it, human life is not within our control. We seem to have a lot of agency, but we don't have to live very long or very honestly to know that a lot of this business of life has to do with waiting. And when we're waiting, a lot of times what we're waiting for are things that are beyond us. And we wait in different ways. And when we give up waiting, we have a word for that. When we give up waiting, we call that despair. When we keep waiting in a way that enlivens something in our spirit, we call that hope. And when we bless someone, we're marking in a ritual way something that is true, I think, whether we acknowledge it or not. And that is that the life of this person that we hold so dear is ultimately not in our hands, but in the hands of another. And that other is someone we choose in the ritual blessing to trust. So that's a big maneuver. When Paul talks in Ephesians 6 about parents raising their children in the training and instruction, or admonition in some older translations, the training and instruction of the Lord, pretty easy to read that as a text that says we should deliver Christian education to our children. That may be maybe a good thing again, but it may be a little bit like the greeting card thing. What it's actually talking about, what Paul's actually on about there, is an attempt to compress it into language the mystery of how we would stir up hunger for God in a child. If you figure that out, please don't publish. Please sit down with someone face to face and tell them what it's been like. Because that's an awesome mystery that we're called into. Now, we're going to do, like Paul writing in Ephesians, we're going to attempt to do with words something that size this morning. And we're going to do it in a couple different ways. We're going to, in a little bit, we're going to have Graham and Sasha and Krim come up here. We're going to pray a blessing over them. So we're going to do that. We're going to make this out loud and act it out. And that's really important. However, that's a ritual that it would be easy to observe and not be a part of. And this matter of blessing other people is actually something that is, I believe, one of our first vocations as humans. This is actually what we're made for. And so the idea of not doing this as participants is abhorrent to me. I think that's a miss. And I was trying to figure out, how can we do this, you know? So I don't know if you remember, a couple weeks ago we talked about this idea of Christianity or Christ and the relationship between Christ and culture as mediated by my relationship with my new iPhone. All right. If you missed that one, it was a beauty. All right. I'm going to go to the podcast. It's so we're gonna actually put that to work this morning. I've got, for those of you that don't have your phones here, or for whom your phones do not connect to email, I have this is called paper. All right. Anyway, I have index cards. You're welcome to write these as well. But what I took the liberty of doing was giving Prim her own Gmail account. So if you, it does exist. It's blessprim@gmail.com. Okay, I'll give you the password. It's yours, not mine. And so you can I'll pass these around. You can write them. You can write blessings for Prim and Grandma Sasha on these cards, or you can just send them to them. Okay, you write them with your phone and send them in. Either way, the goal here is that they would continue to exist. And although you may get more of them, I did delete the greeting emails from the Gmail people, because I don't think anyone's first communication should be from Gmail as an institution. And so Prim's first blessings will not come from the staff at Google. So as you wish. There's no special language that goes with this. In case you're feeling mystified, just take I would suggest, rather than thinking, how do I say this, think about what you want Prim to know when she's old enough to know. Something about the blessing that she received from this community on this day. These are more than hopes and well wishes. This is the offering of yourself to herself. I'm going to give us a few minutes with that. strongly suspect that by the time Prim can read these, Gmail will be a thing of the past. But they'll be archived somewhere. In the ether. And she will know something unique about the love of this community for her. So, Graham, Sasha, Prim, you all done your second breakfast there? Come on up here, girl.
And I think just by way of acknowledging the fullness of the size of the circle of family, we should all say, hello, Brittany. Hello, Brittany. There you go. On the other side of that thing, it looks like a blank piece of metal with an apple. I want to invite you to come and stand with us. Leave room for Brittany to see through, but come, anybody wants to come and join us here and be with us in a prayer blessing. Thank you all. On behalf of Graham and Sasha and Prim, let me extend to you an invitation to a continued party after this one. At 1 o'clock at 7, just told me, 7 something.
798
Grove. 798 Grove. All right.
We'll be back after this, as soon as we get out.
And just so you know, if you're not off to the party, feel free to hang. Although you should be aware that this morning, after we have some time to sing together as worship, there'll be some people that we've probably never seen that will suddenly show up and start taking away the chairs because there's a film happening in the Sea Gallery and you need somewhere to sit. So just so you know what's going on. Luke, Becky, why don't you come and meet us?